This Marketplace podcast is supported by Ascensus, helping people dream bigger, aim higher, and save more with financial confidence. Unleash the power of your retirement savings plan with innovative technology that makes things easy, top-notch service from experts who care, and flexible solutions that can grow with you. For more than 40 years, Ascensus has been helping savers achieve their goals. We can help you achieve yours, too. Learn more at Ascensus.com. That's ASCENSUS.com.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico. More than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Well, let's see. The week that was, of course, cars with no drivers and houses that are haunted. In that order, by the way, from American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Friday, today, October the 27th, is what my calendar says. Good as always to have you along. The conversation about the past 5 days in this economy that we're about to have is going to run the gamut from the very macroeconomic to the granularly political with some stops in between. And we are going to have that conversation with Kate Davidson. She's at Bloomberg, and Neela Richardson. She is at ADP. Hey, you two.
Hi, Kai.
Hey, Kai.
Neela, let me start with you. I will start with PCE that came out this morning, the Federal Reserve's favorite indicator of inflation, as we know, personal consumption expenditures. On target, I guess one would say, from what it was a month ago, 3.4% year on year. Inflation the past 3 months is like 2-something%, so we're closer to where the Fed wants it to be. I guess I just throw that out there and say, what do you think?
I think that we're heading in the right direction, but it's not a slam dunk yet, unfortunately, because there's other data that surrounds those inflation numbers that move basically sideways. There wasn't a lot of progress through the third quarter. And that other data was the fact that the economy had this huge growth spurt of 4.9%, and it was based on the back of the consumer that's still spending. So if this keeps up, there may be some threat of a reacceleration in inflation, and that's what the Fed has to watch, not just where it's been trending, but where it might be going over the next 3 to 4 months.
You know, it's funny, Kate. Neela stole, without knowing it, obviously, the next bullet on my list of questions, which is simply, we're still spending. That is a good thing, and it's also a bad thing.
Yeah. I mean, you know, the fact is the Fed, of course, you know, is happy to see inflation coming down and the economy still healthy. I mean, it's certainly not what they and many people would have expected a year ago or a year and a half ago when they started these aggressive rate increases, right? Like history just tells us that you need a lot of weakening in the economy. You need the unemployment rate to shoot up to make the kind of progress that we've seen. And yet, as Neela said, to sort of make it over the finish line to really get prices stable and get back to their goal, they are still sticking to this idea that things need to cool down a little bit, people. I mean, 4.9% GDP growth is just not, they just don't see, they continue to see that as not really sustainable. So, yeah, it's great that folks are feeling good, they're going out, they're doing things, and that they feel, you know, financially secure, or at least that their spending would suggest that they do. You know, sentiment measures are a different story. But that makes them nervous, right? That's just going to lead to more inflation.
So, Neela, something Kate just said there actually prompts this thought. Consumer sentiment is not great. People feel lousy about the economy because prices are still elevated, even though inflation is coming down. And you get that to some degree. But economy is growing at 4.9%. Unemployment is at 3.8%. What is one to do if one is trying to manage this economy?
you know, consumers are struggling a bit with this economy. There's some really good news, and I'm going to end with the good news. But
okay.
According to the consumer sentiment that we data that we just saw, consumers expect inflation to go up next year. So that's not great news for the Fed. And they're looking at gas prices to make that assessment. Consumers are pretty specific when they're looking at price increases. They're looking at things that the Fed generally abstracts from, which is food and energy prices. But unfortunately, that's, you know, how they interact with inflation most often. But the good news about all of this is the very low unemployment rate that the economy is still holding on to, under 4%. Mm-hmm. Very little layoffs as seen by initial job claims numbers. Job openings are still stronger than they were before the pandemic. And so there's opportunities out there still. And wages are finally, real wages are finally besting inflation, which wasn't always the case. So in terms of the labor market, there's still some more support. It's just the consumer doesn't know what's around the corner. Neither does the Fed. So they're both in the same boat.
Right. Okay. So, Kate, there is a Fed meeting around the corner next week. And not to give everybody an insight into how I write my questions for the thoughts that I'm going to pose to you guys, but the next bullet on my list here says, Fed next week, data, blah, blah, blah. Powell's going to come out and say, we've got to wait for the data to show us what to do. And I'm not asking whether they're going to raise or pause or what, but what more do they need to see? Just something in unemployment or economy slowing? What do you think they're looking for?
Yeah, well, I'll tell you for sure they're going to pause or continue to pause, right? Ooh, hold rates steady. Ooh, they've signaled that like
okay.
very clearly.
All right, that's we'll just play the tape next time you're on, Kate, if you're wrong. I'm just saying.
Uh-oh. Well, I hope I didn't just get myself in trouble. Right. But yeah, I mean, there's nothing that they've signaled so far. All the signs are pointing toward holding rates steady at this meeting coming up. The big question is really, the focus is really on what they're going to do at their final meeting of the year in December, right? Whether they're going to hike another time. So, you know, I think what they're looking for, what Fed officials have said, and what Jay Powell in particular said most recently, is we will be looking for additional evidence that the economy is still resilient, the growth is resilient, and if there's any kind of you know, sort of slowing in this improvement in the labor market. Mm-hmm. In other words, you know, labor force participation has been picking up, job growth has been cooling. Those are signs that are good. But then we had this gangbusters jobs report, right? Remember a few weeks back showing that job gains in September were massive. So they're not going to have another jobs report, unfortunately, before this meeting next week. That report comes out on Friday. The meeting is on Wednesday, but they'll be looking very closely at that. And they're going to continue to look at the data, you know, on spending, you know, retail sales, because they want to make sure that there's not a reacceleration in the economy happening, which you know, which could feed into inflation.
All right, so Neela, this is sort of not a fair question to put on you, and I don't mean to put the entire burden of the economic profession on your shoulders, but you're the trained economist in this conversation, and here's my question. How come we, and by we I mean you economists, were so wrong about how this was going to play out? That we didn't have the recession that's been 6 months away for a year and a half now, that the labor market actually didn't react to rising interest rates. Is it just that it's post-pandemic and it's different now?
I'm proud to speak for all economists when I say, yeah, the economy isn't behaving according to plan. It hasn't throughout this pandemic and recovery. Generally, when the Fed raises interest rates, it's been so effective. It's why it's the primary policy move of the Fed, is that it tends to slow down the economy. In fact, it tends to slow it so far down that it goes into recession.
Right, right.
So economists like to look at data, and our historical data tells us that the economy slows down or goes into recession after the Fed does a rate hiking cycle of this magnitude. This is 500 basis points or 5 percentage points up in, you know, a very short time period. Instead, what did we see? We saw the economy grow by 4.9% in the third quarter. We saw consumers go from pretty much flat growth the quarter before to 4% annualized growth in the third quarter. We see a labor market where we're still under 4% unemployment and job gains are still high. So none of these interest rate effects are predictable using old data. The economy's DNA seems to have shifted a bit.
Huh. Interesting. All right. Last thing, Kate, go ahead.
It's Taylor's fault, Kai.
It's Taylor's fault. That's right. Everybody's buying concert tickets. And Beyonce as well, of course, because there's all kinds of concerts. All right. Look, let me one quick one here, Kate, for you now. And you got 45 seconds once I finish asking you this question. We now have a Speaker of the House, Mike Johnson of Louisiana. He is extremely socially conservative. He worked to nullify and undermine the 2020 election. I want to talk about his fiscal priorities here for one second. And I'm going to play a piece of tape from his speech where he took the gavel.
We have to bring relief to the American people by reining in federal spending and bringing down inflation.
Forget the inflation part. Let's talk about reining in federal spending. Do you suppose that his inauguration now as Speaker brings us a new wave of austerity movement in the Capitol?
No.
Okay.
Short answer.
Okay.
I think that there's a renewed focus for sure on deficits. But the fact is that the reason that deficits this year have been climbing, and they really have, it's a concern, is really about revenues. It's really on the revenue side. And so I think that Republicans have talked for a long time about reining in spending. And there's definitely automatic issues on the automatic spending side, you know, Social Security and Medicare that probably need to be dealt with. But revenues as a share of GDP are very low. And I think that that's where you're really going to get more bang for the buck. And of course, Republicans don't want to raise taxes. So I think that that's the problem there.
All right. Kate Davidson at Bloomberg, Neil Richardson at ADP on a Friday afternoon. Thanks, you two.
Thank you, Kai.
Thanks, Kai.
Have a nice weekend. On Wall Street today, a rare win for tech stocks to end a rough week. The blue chips took a hit, though. Details, numbers, y'all know the drill. Conversation about bonds the past couple of weeks here and elsewhere in the economic and sometimes of late the mainstream press has been about government bonds. Yields have been going up from 3.5% or so back in May to 4.8% today, 5% on Monday if you were paying attention. And that's been happening as investors have finally taken the hint, and by investors I mean bond traders, that the Fed is going to keep interest rates higher for longer given how strong this economy still is. See also that 4.9% GDP growth number. Now, we care about rising bond yields because they make a whole lot of other things more expensive. Mortgages, for one. Credit card debt and municipal debt for two more. And as Marketplace's Justin Ho reports, corporate debt has been getting more expensive too.
Corporate bond yields have been rising at an even faster pace than government bond yields, hitting recent highs.
Levels that surpassed October of last year, which were kind of the post-Great Financial Crisis highs, now we're even above that.
That's Winnie Caesar, global head of strategy at CreditSights. She says that's in large part because investors are getting a little more concerned.
That corporate America, which has a pretty hefty amount of debt outstanding, is now going to have to pay more to refinance that debt.
Corporations issue new debt all the time. They already have existing bonds, and those bonds mature. So now that new bonds are more expensive, they might have to make some decisions on where to cut back.
Ranging from capital expenditures to mergers and acquisitions, building a new factory somewhere.
That's John Bai, a finance professor at Northeastern University. He says some of those decisions can be easy to make. Maybe a company builds two factories instead of four. But other decisions can be painful. If interest rates get too high?
The other lever, unfortunately, that companies will likely pull is, number one, cut down on R&D. And number two, cut on labor force.
That said, many companies aren't necessarily at the point where they have to start cutting back. Matteo Arena, a professor at Marquette University, says a lot of companies re-upped their debt a few years ago when interest rates were low. Thinking was?
Even if we don't need this money in the next 2 years, we probably need the money 5-10 years from now. We borrow now, this bond is going to be good for 20-30 years.
And a lot of those same companies have a lot of cash on hand, in large part because consumers are still spending. Guy Labat at Janney Montgomery Scott says that's reduced the need for new debt.
Corporations are earning more revenues, and they have those revenues in part to pay off some of their existing debt load.
Labat says when you look at how corporate debt compares to corporate earnings, that ratio is looking pretty healthy. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
The The big auto industry news this week was, of course, the tentative deal between the UAW and Ford. A close second and arguably more critical to the future of the auto industry was word that General Motors has suspended its driverless taxi service across the country. Cruise is the name of that service. Specifically, GM has suspended unsupervised driverless cabs, as in with no human standing by just in case, after they were banned here in California over safety concerns. And this is putting the brakes on a self-driving car industry that had finally seemed to be getting up to speed. Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino has that one.
This has been a big year for driverless cars. Fleets of robo-taxis have been operating in San Francisco, Phoenix, and Austin, with pilots in more than a dozen other cities.
We see lots of acceptance and lots of comfort in riding in these vehicles.
Billy Riggs is a professor of engineering and management at the University of San Francisco. He says autonomous vehicles could make cities more livable, equitable, and safe. Cruise and its competitor Waymo say their data show these cars perform better than human drivers.
The particular instance that caused the setback is such an outlier.
Earlier this month, a human-driven car hit a pedestrian in San Francisco. It threw her into the path of an autonomous cruise car, which then attempted to pull over, but it dragged her almost 20 feet.
These cars, they have no knowledge. They don't reason. They just do what they're told. They do what they're programmed.
Missy Cummings is a professor of robotics at George Mason University. She says if everything goes the way the system expects, it works really well. If not...
Indeed, this is the crux of the problem with AI.
The technologies that power driverless cars, like LiDAR sensors and machine learning algorithms, are quickly advancing, but it's hard to program for all eventualities, says Gary Marcus, professor emeritus at NYU and author of Rebooting AI, Building Artificial Intelligence We Can Trust.
There are just too many outliers, so it's like playing a game of whack-a-mole.
He says the challenges with driverless cars could have lessons for other uses of machine learning, like chatbots.
It all revolves ultimately around, do you really understand the world, or are you just parroting circumstances you've seen before?
He says there are a lot of edge cases in fields where language models could be used, as in medicine or law, where, like on the road, the stakes are high. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
Two words, gang, pod and cast. We got one. You should check it out. Coming up, ghosts and ghouls and what else now?
Vampires came back in a big way a couple of years ago. Witches are always very classic.
But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's down 366 today. That's 1.1%, 32,417. The NASDAQ gained 47 points, 0.4%, 12,643. The S&P 500 down 19. That's almost 0.5%, 41.17 there. For the 5 days gone by, the Dow down 2.1%. The NASDAQ off 2.6%. S&P 500 down about 2.5%. Bond prices, well, they rose. Thanks for asking. The yield on the 10-year T-note down to 4.84%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
And now a word from our sponsors at Betterment. Do you want your money to dream big? Do you want your money to be a total self-starter? Are you annoyed that your money doesn't work hard enough? Don't worry. Betterment is here to help. Betterment is the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. Their automated technology is built to help maximize returns. Meaning, when you invest with Betterment, your money can auto-adjust as you get closer to your goal, rebalance if your portfolio gets too far out of line, and your dividends are automatically reinvested. That can increase the potential for compound returns. In other words, your money is breaking a sweat while you can be breaking bread. You'll never picture your money the same way again. Betterment, the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. Visit Betterment.com to get started. Investing involves risk. Performance is not guaranteed.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. The inflation report we got this morning, PCE by name, of course, was chock-a-block with interesting details. Among them, the main drivers of inflation in both goods and services. Taking up space in both categories? Healthcare. Hospitals and nursing homes on the services side, prescription drugs on the goods side. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams spent some time today talking to people about healthcare and inflation and healthcare inflation in this economy.
When it comes to healthcare, the PCE doesn't just track what you're paying at the doctor's office or the pharmacy.
So the PCE is actually showing the total that both consumers pay out of their wallet, but also what their health plan is paying.
Kritika Amin is a policy expert at the nonprofit health research organization, KFF, and says there is a lag in this data, but it does show what a significant role healthcare plays in the rising cost of living.
This year, healthcare made up about 18% of the U.S. economy. By the end of the decade, healthcare is expected to make up about a fifth of the U.S. economy.
A big part of those rising costs is demographics. Katie Smith Sloan is president and CEO of Leading Age, which represents nonprofits that provide aging services. She says while we have better treatments for things like Parkinson's and dementia,
people are also living longer with those diseases. And therefore, the kind of care that they need is intensive, it's very personal, and it's delivered over a long period of time.
And getting more expensive over time. Despite all that, healthcare inflation over the past year or so has been rising more slowly than the rest of the economy, says Leighton Koo, who directs George Washington University's Center for Health Policy Research.
But we expect that to sort of revert back to normal patterns over the next couple of years.
The normal pattern being healthcare costs rising faster than everything else. He says in the future,
we expect that healthcare prices overall will be rising a little more than 4% per year. And we hope that overall inflation for other goods goes back down below that level. But of course, you know, it's an uncertain world.
And with wars, volatile energy prices, and climate change, that uncertainty isn't limited to what's happening with drug or hospital list prices. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
Fear is a big business in this economy. Scary movies, yes, of course. Scary rides, too, at the amusement park of your choice. This time of year, though, scary really comes front of mind, even if slightly cartoonishly. Giant inflatable arachnids in our yards, 12-foot-tall skeletons, and scarier things right alongside. With Halloween just around the corner, Marketplace's Sabri Benishore has this on another slice of the fear business, haunted houses.
Okay, so we're entering the haunted estate. So this is sort of like a maze that we're going through. A very dark maze with...
Oh, my God! Oh,
this was at the Frightmare Farms Haunted Scream Park, about 30 miles north of Syracuse, New York. There's a haunted hayride through the woods, a maze infested with a crop of sentient and vengeful pumpkins angry at having been carved.
Farmer John!
How's your harvest this year?
That is a zombie Mad Hatter-like maitre d' who goes by Xavier. Frightmare Farms is one of at least 7,500 haunted or Halloween-related attractions in the U.S. The multi-acre park employs more than 100 people for just a couple months out of the year. The park is open to the public for just 11 nights. Nicole Ginsberg is a co-owner.
So our season is obviously only October, but we actually work on our show all year round.
A lot of the staff here are actors, and they have to navigate a precarious balance between real fear and play fear.
That is an interesting line that we walk because, you know, it really is fun to be scared.
Sam Herwood is an assistant manager at Frightmare. He plays the character of Xavier, and he trains the actors on how to frighten effectively.
It's about having fun, and you want to playfully scare people, but also people will buy into it.
Haunted houses really are just a subset of the theme park industry, but a quirky one. Lynn Vincent is an associate professor of management at Syracuse University and is studying haunted houses.
Fear is a negative, aversive emotion, yet there are industries and organizations that make fear their product.
There's a whole spectrum of what that looks like. On the absolute very extreme end,
you have haunts that do crazy extreme things, like they make you touch and eat bugs, they buzz your hair off, they electrocute you.
Philip Hernandez is founder of the Haunted Attraction Network, which publishes news for the haunted attraction industry.
But honestly, people don't really want that. The purpose of a haunted house is to entertain. It's not to scare. I think that's the common misconception.
Some haunted houses are more like festivals, others like escape rooms. They tend to have one thing in common, though, a very small labor pool that has time to do this work for 2 months a year. Take Herwood, for example, who has played a bloody surgeon, a coal miner, and a mortician.
My full-time job is actually a seventh grade math teacher.
Scream parks need a lot of scary people, and there are only so many math teachers. Again, Philip Hernandez.
Staffing is the biggest challenge that I hear.
Finding labor actually haunts a lot of the fear supply chain.
There's a lot of vendors that are small businesses. You're talking about under 10 employees, but they make specialty animatronics, you know, that are only for haunted houses, and that's their whole business. Well, they're still dealing with staffing up.
That and supply chain problems have made the supply of Halloween monster robots tight. They often sell out instantly. For an industry founded on a basic and primitive emotion, haunting is actually pretty trend-driven. What scary looks like changes over the years. Nicole Ginsberg again, co-owner of Frightmare Farms.
Vampires came back in a big way a couple of years ago. Witches are always very classic. Serial killers were there for the 80s, 90s, early 2000s.
Sometimes what's scary is an echo of something society is going through. Sometimes it's just a chainsaw-wielding monster running through the crowds. Not everyone will find every theme scary, but that's not really the point. Frightmare Farms visitor Marissa Falasco just got her photo taken with a 12-foot-tall monster.
There's so much in the world that you should be scared about, so sometimes it's nice to, come and be scared about something that actually isn't scary.
But also, it is actually, in fact, kind of scary. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, a quick update to a story Matt Levin did for us earlier this week about the Google antitrust trial going on right now. The Justice Department's accusing the search engine Behemoth of unfairly using its market power and many billions of dollars to ensure it is the default search tool on devices of all sorts, most particularly Apple. Anyway, today we learned in that trial exactly how many billions of dollars Google has paid. $26.3 billion to be precise, and that was in just 1 year, 2021. So over time, I believe the technical term is boatloads of billions of dollars is what Google has paid to have its way. All right, super quick, here's your moment of economic context. Forget the Fed meeting next week. Forget Jay Powell. The Russian central bank raised its key rate 2 percentage points today to 15%. Think about that. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace's executive producer is Nancy Fargali. Donna Tam is the executive editor. Neil Scarborough is vice president and general manager. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you Monday. Everybody have yourselves a great weekend, all right? This is APM.
Hey everyone, it's Rima Khreis, host of This is Uncomfortable. If you're looking for some good recommendations on books to read, Well, you should join This Is Uncomfortable's Summer Book Club. Every other week in our newsletter, we'll share a new book that'll make you rethink your relationship to money, class, and work, while also featuring an interview with the author or an expert on the topic. Plus, when you join, you'll be entered in a giveaway where you could win some This Is Uncomfortable merch. Be sure to check it out. Sign up today at marketplace.org/bookclub.